or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Robert Neuwirth is an interesting character. He has spent 4 years in the slums of Nairobi, Mumbai, Rio, and Istanbul. And what did he do there? He was trying to learn about what he calls the informal economy. One could call it the underground economy, under the table economy, that is quite pervasive there. And in his book, which is his most recent book, he's written about a couple of them at least, that book is called Stealth of Nations, subtitle, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. He reports that the underground economy is, next to the United States economy, the largest in the world. $10 trillion a year, including a trillion right here in the U.S. What is work life like for the people in those unregulated economies? And are there lessons, just perhaps, that we all might learn that might inform our work lives? Robert Neuwirth has written articles for Harper's, Scientific American, The Nation, Forbes. We'll talk about two different publications, Nation and Forbes, and The New York Times. And he has achieved my goal. I want to do this somehow before it's on my bucket list at the top, to give a TED Talk. And he is my guest this morning. I work with Marty Nemko. Robert Neuwirth, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me here, Marty. And I'm sure you will reach that goal of the TED Talk.
That's BS. How the hell do you know? I could be terrible. What would make you think that I have the gravitas to do what you did, give a TED Talk?
Well, you know, if you have something to say, not about yourself,
right,
but about a
right
point
right
in the world that's unique, then you might be able to give a TED Talk.
I would love to do one called Reinventing Education, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, different topic.
Yes, okay. Let's talk about you and your 4 years and further musings about lessons to potentially learn from the underground economy.
Sure.
What are, first of all, just a few examples of businesses that exist in the informal economy, in the world slums?
Well, you know, it goes beyond the slums, but starting out in, and I quarrel with the term slum, I'll call them squatter communities or homesteaded communities, but starting there in the most basic level, every community anywhere in the world, legal or illegal, has a couple of businesses, right? They have markets, restaurants, and bars. And I would wager you, I haven't been in every shanty town in the world, but I would wager you that every shanty town in the world has at least one market, one restaurant, and one bar. And these are the kinds of businesses that people immediately start right up. Once you got a couple of people in the neighborhood, they need a place to buy food. They need a place to buy, you know, the sundries of life, shaving cream and razor blades and fabric softener and detergent, toothpaste. And they need a place to relax. And all three of those things are some of the first businesses that get set up in these places. And then you find someone's good at cutting hair, they set up a hair salon. Someone else has realized that if they buy mangoes in bulk down at the wholesale market, they can make a profit if they sell them individually or by the dozen in the shanty town. And so they make an increment of profit, and it goes on from there to construction laborers and, you know, even much larger businesses that outside of the shanty towns that deal with, you know, import and export of things like electronics and consumer goods. So it really runs the gamut.
I'm picturing two very different visions of what that visually would look like. I picture on one end the individual who's got a bunch of razor blades that he or she imported from China or whatever, and he's simply wandering around the shanty town and with his with a sign or whatever is, or saying that he's got razor blades. And then I have this vision of a kind of a flea market where within this shanty town where maybe, you know, 10,000 people live in their cardboard huts, there is this central area where a bunch of these individual entrepreneurs, if you will, meet so that there's this what they call plottage, collective, are both of those equally viable?
Absolutely. And they both go on. I mean, the most common thing is someone, throwing down a blanket somewhere and putting some products on it to try to sell them. Or what they do in Africa sometimes is, very enterprisingly, they use the hood of a car, and that's your display window for the products that you're selling. And so some guy who's selling shoes arrays all the pair of shoes that he has on the hood of the car. And people also use their own homes. So they will cut a hole in the window of their house and devote half of the single room they have to the products that they're going to sell. And the other half is sleeping and cooking and living. And that's the kind of way that they start their business. And everyone starts it hoping that they'll grow and they'll ultimately move it out of their house into some public square where there's a market, or maybe even, rent a little stall where they'll actually have a store in addition to their house, and then they can have the full room for living in and have their merchandise somewhere else. So it really, again, it looks like the spread of businesses that we sometimes see here. I mean, if you walk down the streets in San Francisco, I'm sure I'm here in New York, you see people sometimes on the street selling stuff.
Of course.
And that's the same way it works in the shantytown.
That was exactly my reaction. I was listening. I mean, this, how many people are daunted in America by the incredible regulations it takes to start a business? And the taxes, et cetera, and they are selling knockoff watches out of a suitcase on the streets of San Francisco, or they're working at home and they're making their family recipe, toffee or biscuits or whatever, and selling them on Craigslist or a Twitter ad. You said that we have $1 trillion of that economy here in the United States. What are some other examples here that are quite remarkably that are analogous to what you might see in the slums of Nairobi?
Well, I mean, people selling clothing, certainly. I mean, everyone, you see that all over the world, that people set up and sell their spare clothing, or maybe they restitch clothing so that they take something that used to be used as a poncho and turn it into a shirt or something like that. And you see that all over the world, that people add some value to it and give it a fashion sort of twang, and then they sell it and make a profit on it. I think that goes on everywhere. So I don't think it's unique to the shantytown or the developing world, and I think it has applicability here. What happens, I mean, San Francisco actually, as it turns out, is a hotbed of this stuff. And, during the, we might call it a depression, we might call it a downturn, depending on where we want to look at it. But 2008, 2009, a lot of people got dusted from their official jobs, and people turned to vending food on the street to make ends meet. And there were a number of people that were written about, Curtis the creme brulee guy, and there's a woman who started a business called Bike Basket Pies, and there's the fellow Brandon Arnovic who started Mission Minis. All of them started informally, off the books, without a license, and then moved forward as their business grew into some sort of a different arrangement. Because, as you aptly point out, when Mission Minis started, they were baking the miniature cupcakes in Brandon's kitchen, and you can't get a license to do that.
It's impossible.
It's simply illegal. There's no way for the government to give you a license to do that. But how do you start a business selling cupcakes for a buck each if you can't do that? Because renting space in a commercial kitchen is going to cost you $25 an hour, maybe more. And how many hours do you have to be there every day? And how many cupcakes do you have to sell? So it's really an impediment, the complications of licensing that we have here in this country.
So there's two sides of me. There is the liberal side of me, and I want to make that argument, and then there is the libertarian, more free market-ish side. The liberal side of me says, this is horrible. Where is the collective responsibility of people to pay their taxes, and we won't have infrastructure, and it's an all-for-me approach, and also the food is not regulated, and so who knows, maybe there isn't sufficiently sanitary conditions, and we should, you know, we have a collective responsibility to discourage that. That's the liberal side of me.
Right.
The more free marketish side of me says, you know, the hurdles that government sets up to run a business are simply meant for the rich. Only the rich can meet all of those requirements, and it leaves the poor ever destitute. And there mm-hmm. are people who are not particularly hireable in the private sector, and so they are left between a rock and a hard place. So they absolutely should be encouraged to, or at least it should be condoned that they should start these small little businesses.
Sure.
Where do you come down? You've mused on this more than I have. Where are your thoughts about this?
It's a, you know, these are really important dilemmas, Marty. And I think the class bias in this is absolutely daunting and damning of the way that we respond to it. And I'll give you two examples from here in New York, where I am. Okay, and I cover this a bit in my book. I interviewed a Mexican immigrant who was selling homemade tamales. She's from Puebla, and they make great tamales and mole and other things, and she was selling them on the street. And she got hassled all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, she had a shopping cart, and she would set up on various corners.
Hassled by the government or by thieves?
No, by the government.
Okay.
By the city.
Okay.
By the police.
Yep.
And then I interviewed a woman who set up a business making olive oil cake. And she's relatively, I mean, she's well-educated, graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design. She's actually a jewelry designer, and this was just a way of making cash for her rent. And she baked olive oil cake in her apartment. And instead of retailing it on the street, she made a deal with a local coffee bar mm-hmm. where they would take all of her olive oil cakes. Mm-hmm. The coffee bar benefits because it has different products mm-hmm. than the standard kind of croissants that everyone
right.
sells. And she benefits because she got the cash. No license. She got paid in cash. She didn't have to package her olive oil cake. She wrapped it up in tin foil and brought it over there.
Right.
She never got pursued. In fact, she was written about and extolled in New York Magazine and some of the other places for this great olive oil cake and how cool that she made it in her house. So we do have this wacky double standard. And most recently, and I haven't spoken with Genoveva about this because it's this is the tamale lady, because it's, you know, people's situations are kind of delicate and I don't want to probe too far. But more recently, I haven't seen her selling her tamales. I've seen her collecting cans and bottles with her husband. And I have a feeling that what that's about, it's not that she can make more money collecting cans and bottles on the streets in New York. It's that she got hassled too many times.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way, there was absolutely no way for her to ever get a license for her home kitchen and vending food on the street. These licenses are limited, and the number hasn't been expanded since the 1970s in New York. So it's a racket that enriches the people who have the licenses who can sell them to other people. So while I'm sympathetic to the idea that everything should be at least guaranteed to be safe or something like that, I do feel that there's a class bias in this. And I do have to say that there are different rules in other developed world countries. So that in the UK, for instance, you can get a license to cook and sell food from your apartment. There are apartment restaurants in London that capitalize on the foodie kind of movement, and they are perfectly able to go to the city and get appropriate licenses to cook and serve food not using a commercial kitchen and to charge for it. And I don't see why that shouldn't be the case here. And I also think that the food safety issue is, if you can require someone like Genoveva to take some courses, she's not trying to poison anyone, nor is she trying to buy substandard product. She's a small merchant. She's trying to make the thing she knows how to make for her family. If we can just accept that and work with it, I think it would be a much better situation for everyone involved rather than just outlawing it entirely in the name of food safety when... You know, who knows what conditions are like behind the scenes in even the fanciest restaurants. Yes,
exactly.
They're inspected, but, you know, it used to be that some of them would flunk regularly and, you know, get away with it.
I think that's a pretense. I think that whole food safety thing is a pretense. Statistically, the odds of people getting sick from an unlicensed food versus a licensed food, I just don't think is that great to justify the mammoth bureaucracy and costs of meeting all these damn regulations. Why don't we think statistically? What is the cost?
And,
let me finish. What is the statistical cost benefit of licensing relative to allowing people the freedom to, for example, make their brown? Barbara, my wife, makes the greatest wonderful brownies. And if she were looking for work and she decided to just, you know, make those brownies and go to all the little cafes, like you say, wrap them in plastic wrap or whatever, you know, the net to get a license would be impossible. It would cost $100,000 or whatever.
Right.
And instead, she should be out. You know, why should the Napa cafes be deprived of Barbara's amazing brownies and her right to make a living? If she can make a living, she's going to more likely turn to crime. Not Barbara particularly, but it seems crazy.
That is the issue, or you know, turn to a much less lucrative kind of thing, like collecting bottles and cans and getting a nickel deposit on them, which is really sad to see Genoveva have to do. There's a lady who made, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, really great tamales. And certainly her other customers felt so, too. And, you know, I do think, I mean, I think you make a really good point. And going back in history, there's always been this concern, this faux concern about food safety. And if you go back to 100 years, to 1906 in New York, where there was this huge campaign against vending carts, and one of the complaints was that, the food's bad, the food's bad, the food's bad. But when the commission that the city set up to study it really investigated it, they found that the vending carts were actually safer than grocery stores.
Interesting.
Because the vending carts had to restock their food every day.
Right.
Whereas the grocery stores could store it in the back room in a little bit of coolness out of the sun, and there was more rotten food in grocery stores than there was on the vending carts. But the vending carts got the bulk of the blame, and no one listened to the statistical argument.
Exactly. I mean, the person who owns their own cart has got a greater pride in the quality of their work. There's fewer breaks in the chain of command, so the food is more likely to be good than... I mean, I go to Trader Joe's, right? And I go to Trader Joe's, and the milk is dated, you know, a certain date, and about a third of the time, it's sour before it reaches the date, which means that while when the milk was processed and was made, it was expected to be good, say, till August 10th, but somewhere along, some people who were working in Trader Joe's or whatever let it out, you know, out of coolness. And so absolutely, it would seem logical that the small little entrepreneurs are going to actually net be healthier, certainly, than the not justifying the enormous costs of regulation, which I believe really is only it's not really about food safety. I fear that the government is just really wanting to make sure that they get their taxes off of every brownie.
Well, and the other issue is just protection for the other businesses.
Yeah, good point.
And, someone, again, in San Francisco was telling me that to get licensed, you know, they were denied a license on a business when they decided to go the legal route because the paper towel dispenser was at the wrong height.
Jeez, right.
You know, these are the kinds of things where, why do we even write that into law? I know that there's an Americans with Disabilities Act, and we do have to pay attention to that, and I think it's a good thing. The question is, when it becomes so micromanaging, it's makes it rather difficult for businesses.
Cost benefit. Every decision needs to be not in the extremis. Like when we make everybody take off their shoes to get on an airplane, what is the increased probability of improvement of humankind life versus the price that people have to pay in terms of time, hassle, and personnel?
Yeah.
Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Robert Neuwirth. He is the author of Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy, you know, more better known as kind of the underground economy, the cash economy, whatever. And he has spent 4 years in the slums of Nairobi, Mumbai, Rio, and Istanbul. We're talking about that as well as implications for America. But now let's go back to those 4 years. That's a very rich set of experiences. What might surprise me about the informal economies of the world, squatter community, slums, whatever word you choose to use?
Well, first of all, the biggest surprise that I had was how welcomed I was everywhere. People just took me in, and I mean, it was a truly humbling experience, Marty, because, you know, if some writer from Kenya took the plane trip over to the United States and moved in next door to me, would I be half as accommodating and helpful to him or her as people were to me? The answer is sadly no. So, you know, I just, I mean, I feel like I have extended family all over the world, and it's an incredible, an amazing thing, and humbling every day how much better people are than I am. But beyond that, one of the most amazing things for me was how structured and organized people got, and how there were tremendously rich networks that were working in these places. Take a shanty town. We tend to think of these shanty towns, slums, squatter communities, whatever you want to call them, as the apotheosis of misery.
Right.
Right. You know, and we have these images of them, of slothful people with nothing to do, impoverished and hanging out and begging. And, you know, there's a truth to that, but it's not the truth. And the amazing thing of going into, I mean, I lived for a while in the biggest mud hut settlement in Nairobi, Kenya, Kibera. And going in there and realizing that the main drags, it's maybe 500,000 people live there, and the main drags are just packed with stores and activity. There is so much work going on there, and so much trade with each other, and the networks that people have to be able to do that, it's just amazing. And so for the lady who has started a business and is bringing in mangoes, and she's bringing in 100-kilo bags of mangoes, and she goes down every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning to the wholesale fruit market, when she comes back to Kibera, there's a guy waiting at the bus stop to carry her thing for her. He carries the big sack on his back, and he gets paid. And so there are all these networks that are making these communities, in some sense, self-sufficient, and the money stays within the community. And that was an amazing lesson to me, that I can't look upon these places. I can't confuse the material deprivation of people with who they are.
Interesting. You describe them as busy. The other mental image I have of them is that they're unhappy. The images we see is of hollow-eyed, poor. Are they, you know, are they... I know you can't generalize, but the people living in the favelas of Rio or whatever, are they, would you estimate, less happy, less content with their existence than the people who are in New York or in San Francisco?
You know, happiness is not based on material possessions. You know, does everyone want more? I mean, do people want electricity and running water, which, incidentally, the people in most of the favelas in Rio actually have, but not every shantytown in the world. Do people want that? Yes. Do they want a toilet? Yeah. I mean, they know what toilets are. They're not, you know, they're not outside of the 21st century in that regard. They want to be on Facebook. You know, if they don't have that, they figure out ways of dealing with that, and they certainly recognize that that sucks. It's a bad thing, but it's not the sum total of their lives. And so people have tremendous energy and tremendous hope. And yeah, there are also people who are despairing and people who feel that they're not being compensated fairly or that they can't get a job. That's also part of the reality. Although, of course, you know, I joke with my friends from Nigeria, for instance. I spent a lot of time in Lagos, Nigeria, and I joke with my friends in Nigeria that with the youth unemployment rate in Nigeria having hit 50% and the standard, you know, full unemployment rate around 27-29%, Nigeria is now European because those numbers are the same as Spain. You know, I mean, this is not only a problem of the developing world. The economic situation in the world causes a lot of misery. And people recognize that that misery is, in some sense, beyond their control. And do people know how to have fun? Yeah, they know how to have fun. And they do have fun. So, you know, happiness is not constrained by the material conditions that you happen to live in or the amount of money that you have. There are deficiencies that people have, but, you know, they're working their damnedest to change this.
I'm wondering, you know, we really legitimately wring our hands when people don't have access to quality health care other than the emergency room. Now,
yes.
There, I imagine they have much less health care.
Yes.
They are living in corrugated, you know, leaky, I'm guessing, you know,
well,
leaky.
Well, it depends where you go, Marty. I mean, let's be honest about, you know, people develop their communities.
How do they get health care in Nairobi, in the slums of Mumbai?
I mean, no one has health care in Nairobi. It's a matter of money. If you have the cash, you can walk into a hospital and you can be treated. If you don't have the cash, you will not be treated. That's the sad reality. But that's true whether you live in a shanty or whether you live in a legal neighborhood. The money buys health care.
Right. Are there a lot of people who are living in leaky, cardboard, walled, corrugated, you know, fiberglass houses? Is that a stereotype or is that real? How pervasive is that?
That's a stereotype. I mean,
okay.
It's real in terms of the more recent shanty towns. It depends whether people have, I mean, there are two factors that I talk about, and this is from my first book, which was called Shadow Cities, which is really about life in the shanty towns.
Mm-hmm.
There are two factors that I talk about. One is staying power, all right? If government just simply wants to bulldoze all these communities and kick the people out, well, they're not going to develop, because they're in a constant war just for survival.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But once government backs off from that, people develop.
Mm.
Once they know that I'm not going to be summarily evicted,
mm-hmm.
you know, they may start out with what you're talking about, cardboard and corrugated fiberglass. But the minute they have money, one cardboard wall is taken down. They do this one wall at a time, and wood is put up.
Mm.
And the minute they finish those four walls and they have more money, one wood wall goes down and a brick wall is put up. And so I talked with an urban planner in Brazil who had a wonderful way of describing this. And he said, you know, she said, actually, in the legal neighborhoods and in the affluent neighborhoods, we get a mortgage. And the bank agrees to give us money, and that enables us to have this house. In the shanty towns, their time is their mortgage.
Mm.
And so they're willing to live like this to produce the better conditions over time. The second thing that they need is what I call access to politics. And the example I use of this is in Istanbul, in Turkey. Through an accident of ancient Ottoman land law, okay, every municipality within the bounds, Istanbul has sub-municipalities within the big city of Istanbul. And every municipality has its own little mayor. There's a big city mayor. Once upon a time, it was Erdogan, who's now the prime minister, rather controversial prime minister.
Right.
Every municipality has the small city mayor. And if you have 2,000 people living in a community, you can petition the federal government to be recognized as a legal sub-municipality, no matter whether you own the land. So as a result, most of the squatter communities in Istanbul have petitioned the federal government and have become in this category known as either ilçe or belediye, which is district or, you know, municipality or city neighborhood or whatever you might be the translation. And that gives them popularly elected governments. So most squatter communities in Istanbul have popularly elected governments that collect user fees to do public works. And it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, it sort of mimics the kind of taxation that you were talking about before here in the States. But it's based on a much more immediate social contract. And the social contract is, if you pay this user fee, you're going to get a park. You're going to get streetlights. You're going to get, I mean, it's neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block. And it's very, people see it.
So,
so they understand the social contract implicit in taxation or user fees.
Right. So it kind of reminds me of the way any government would originate. There's always a need for certain efficiencies that come from collective action. And
sure.
So a group of people, maybe cavemen in the beginning, decided to collaborate. And, you know, they wanted to have a park or whatever, something.
Or a better hunt.
A better hunt, exactly.
You know, so all these things, I mean, I agree with you that it is like governments forming in prototype in some way.
And it's only what happens is, like, any good idea, it gets expanded, and unfortunately government tends to just expand itself, and then we get to the morass that we, for example, have in the United States, where you have this massive government with so many regulations that the benefits that derive may, depending upon your political view, are the liabilities outweigh the costs, and the liabilities and the regulations outweigh the benefits.
Yeah.
Okay, let's. We need to kind of bring this to a conclusion here.
Sure.
Let's conclude with talking about, well, first of all, is there anything else? I mean, it's just humanly fascinating to me to listen to you talk about the things that might surprise me about underground economies. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that our listeners don't, that our listeners hear before we end our segment?
Well, two things. One is it's global. Okay, and I learned that from African merchants who journey to China to buy goods and funnel them back to Africa. They do this because, you know, there isn't industrial production in Africa for a wide variety of reasons. I mean, there's some, but it's hard to start.
Right.
So there's global flows of trade worth, you know, millions and millions of dollars that are going on through this.
So give me a specific example of that. What's an example of that really occurring that you can walk me through the chain of the supply chain, if you will?
Okay. Well, two things. One is, I mean, mobile phones is a beautiful example. It's a formal economy that is built on an informal economy. That's fascinating. So you have all these major multinational mobile phone companies that are establishing mobile networks. And I'll take Nigeria as the example that I know. So you've got,
and it's the biggest country. Isn't Nigeria, doesn't it, like one-sixth of the population?
By population, the largest country in Africa. Between 1 in 6 and 1 in 7 Africans is Nigerian,
right,
which is amazing.
Right.
It's also one of the most entrepreneurial countries I've ever been to, where everyone is trying to be, you know, their own boss, figuring out an angle, and try to capitalize on it. It's an amazing place. However, just to focus on this for a moment, so you have all these mobile phone networks that are global multinational companies, but it's all pay-as-you-go. They don't sell you a plan. They don't sell you the phone. All they sell you is airtime, a SIM card and airtime. All right. So how does that work? Well, where do you get the phone? You get the phone because Nigerian merchants figured out that they could go to Africa and they could pick up phones, whether pirated or real name brand.
Go to Africa, really, you mean, or go to China?
Go to China.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Right.
Go to China and pick these up real cheap and smuggle them back into Nigeria and sell them. And so I bought a completely legal Nokia 1011 when I was there. It's a stick phone, you know, has no features, but it has a battery that'll last you 7 days. So it was really useful for me in an environment where electricity is really unstable, and it's useful to a lot of people in Lagos, Nigeria. I bought it in Lagos for $40. One phone, not even buying in bulk. I priced it in Guangzhou, China. It was $10. If you buy it in bulk, it's probably 8, maybe 7, maybe less. So the point is that merchants have recognized that this is a supply chain that they can bring back to Africa, and it'll be at a price people can afford. The second thing is, who sells you the airtime? Well, it's not the big mobile phone company, it turns out. The big mobile phone company produces the scratch cards, which entitle you to airtime, and they're sold by a completely unlicensed, informal, untax-paying sales force of people on the street, known as the umbrella market. They sit under umbrellas at the side of the road, and they sell you airtime. It's real convenient. You can pull up in your car, you can buy airtime. You can walk down the street, you can buy airtime everywhere. And when I spoke with one of the mobile phone companies, they indicated to me that they make the bulk, the vast bulk of their profit from selling airtime. So all of their profit of these major multinational mobile phone companies in Nigeria is predicated on an informal labor force selling scratch cards on the street.
You said there were two examples. What was
the second example that I wanted to bring up is how American companies and European companies have recognized the power inherent in shanty towns and the informal economy. The example I'll use is Procter & Gamble, but you can really use Colgate-Palmolive. You can use any of the major consumer goods companies. They've recognized that, look, you know, their biggest customer in aggregate is Walmart. Mm-hmm. About 15% of Procter mm-hmm. & Gamble's business, right? Mm-hmm. But for us in the United States, it's not growing. That business is flat.
Hmm.
Okay? Where's their growth? It's another 15% of their business, which is in what they call high-frequency stores, which is stores of three cash registers or less throughout the developing world.
Hmm.
And what Procter & Gamble told me is that they don't care the legal status of the store. They want their product to be there. And they've recognized that this is the greatest relationship marketing that they can create.
Hmm.
Because if I live in a shanty town and I buy all my stuff from the guy next door who opened a little dry goods store in his shanty, right, I go there every day.
Hmm.
They did market research in Mexico and discovered people go there 6 days a week.
Hmm.
You might go to Walmart once every month,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but you go to that store 6 days a week, and you might buy a one-use sachet of detergent because that's all the money you have. Now, that's a greater profit margin for Procter & Gamble, and it's a chance for them to hook you, right,
yeah.
in this great marketing. So they need their products there, and they know that you're going to grow, and you're going to establish a family, and you're going to keep using Downy fabric softener or Tide laundry detergent mm-hmm. or whatever it may be, or Colgate toothpaste.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these major companies have recognized that this is where the growth is. This is where their business is going to grow. It's not going to grow here in the United States selling through big box stores. It's going to grow through the small sale through the kiosks in the shanty towns of the world.
And is it fair to say, that bringing things back to the United States, that given the ever-growing gap between rich and poor and the hollowed-out middle class of people who cannot, because it's so expensive to hire an American these days, and when companies can more easily offshore or automate, that there is going to be ever more Americans who are going to be forced into the underground economy, and that, in fact, this is likely to continue to be the fastest-growing segment of the world economy? Do you buy that analysis?
Yes, I do. I mean, I do think it's going to continue to be very important here. I think it's a way that people augment their incomes and survive during tough financial times.
Yep.
And I see these tough financial times continuing.
And so what overall, as we now capstone this interview, what are the lessons that perhaps, you know, these other squatter communities, again, underground economies, slums, whatever you want to call them, they have unfortunately been in existence for a lot longer than the small little versions of those that exist in America. What lessons might we, overall as an American nation and individuals who are forced or choosing to live in the underground economy, what lessons might we all learn from them?
Well, the first, I would say, from the larger perspective is let's find a middle ground here. The punitive approach of driving people who are just trying to make a living out of business, I think, is futile.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said before, sort of drives people towards the criminal, which I think is reprehensible.
Or you said, like you said, collecting bottles on the street. I saw a 55 or 60-year-old woman with a big plastic bag around her back collecting bottles.
But
exactly.
Look, recycling is a noble profession, and I'm not going to downgrade it, but I do think that there are people with skills who could do other things if the barriers were just less.
Right.
So I do think from a legal standpoint, municipalities might want to look into how they can create this middle ground where businesses incubate. I mean, I can throw out ideas just off the top of my head. Could there be a 3-year grace period for incorporating business?
Interesting.
Or for getting a license?
Interesting.
Or based on the size of your business? I don't know.
Incubation,
you know,
it's a great concept.
People can think about this. How can you incubate and grow businesses, you know, in the same way that, look, Dick Sears, who started Sears Roebuck, started selling watches out of a train station in Minnesota, right? Selling to the people passing through on the trains. You know, my bet is, and I don't have the exact history of this, he wasn't incorporated from day one. And he wasn't Sears Roebuck from day one.
Right.
You know, he used it to grow something that became a company that at one time was the largest American retail firm.
Great point. I got to tell insert a little anecdote like this. My father, you know, he was a Holocaust survivor and came to the United States, and he owned this little tiny store in a terrible neighborhood. And on Sundays, he would go to the Lower East Side to buy the shirts and stuff, quote, wholesale.
Yeah.
And there were these guys on the street selling, like, pickles.
Sure. This,
an Eastern European guy used to make good pickles back in the old country in Poland or whatever, and I would bet my life that he was not a licensed, you know, pickle guy. But was he doing any harm selling that? And I think, and I remember them being happy. I remember even whether they grew or not, that this there's something about the simple local business that if they weren't so unfettered might net lead to a better
yeah,
world,
and,
better country.
And you know, was he happier than my grandfather who worked in a sweatshop?
Good point.
And my grandfather was happy to get out of the sweatshop, and he had a candy store, right? But you know, he also did his informal economy thing by he had a pinball machine and he had a tilt switch, so he could tilt the pinball machine if someone was getting too good at it, because in those days pinball machines paid off in dimes. But at any rate, that's a family story that my mom probably wouldn't be happy about me telling. But you know, the second thing I just wanted to say is that resilience for people. All right, we should be encouraging people to be self-sufficient and resilient. And if people want to start businesses and want to do something, we have to have a way in this country of saying, yeah, let's do it.
Isn't that what the bankruptcy laws are for?
Yeah. And you know, we have to empower people. And that's what I meant about the, you know, the 3-year grace period or something like that for incubating a business. Just something that enables people to start things that they're passionate about. Because most businesses that you're passionate about start out with the passion. They don't start out with the license.
Anything else? One more. You're a fantastic guest. It's been a pleasure having you on, so I'm kind of trying to milk you until as long as I can. What's one more lesson that perhaps all of us who are concerned about work, individually or as a nation, can learn from the people who have spent so many generations in the squad
cities?
The other
thing I would say is that it takes time, you know, to grow a business. Your bottom line is not going to be so great at first. And you have to be willing to work through that. And that's a classic business argument that every business knows, right? But we need the example I use, and it's an amazing story. There's a guy in the garbage dump in Lagos, the largest garbage dump there, and he spent 16 years as a scavenger, right? Picking things and selling them to brokers, right? Scavenging recycler until he could earn enough money to set himself up as a broker. That he's now the guy buying and selling the scrap from his fellow scavengers. And the way he looks at it, it's been an amazing achievement in his life.
Of course.
And he feels like the future is bright. And in fact, you know, his business card, he handed me his business card. It didn't say anything about the garbage dump. It didn't say anything about the slum Ajegunle where he grew up. His business was called Right Time Investments. And his view was, look, I'm totally informal, and I don't pay taxes. Yeah, that's true. But I want to grow, and I'm earning a 20% profit margin here, and what I need is more capital. And microcredit was too small for him because he was already beyond that. He needed something. The banks wouldn't lend to him because he wasn't, quote-unquote, formal. He needed some way of growing his business, and that was his frustration. Because he would reinvest his capital, but he wanted more because he knew he could grow. And so two things I would say is time and then having these in-between spaces where we can incubate businesses.
Well, you have certainly, I think, contributed to incubating all of our thinking about the beyond the standard route of everything from what kind of businesses to start to resilience to where to get your money to patience, and just where simply it was intrinsically fascinating. I really think in the arc of your life, I'm a career counselor, and I think of Robert Neuwirth, who had the guts to go and leave his comfy, cushy, whatever, brownstone New York City existence and spend years literally in no doubt the not exactly comfortable environments of the squatter communities of Nairobi and Mumbai and Rio. I think the world owes you a debt of gratitude, and I certainly do.
Well, thank you, Marty. I appreciate it. Do I have a minute for a story?
You sure do. Please go ahead.
It's a personal story.
Great.
Right? You know, I was working as a trade journalist. Writing for a magazine called Editor and Publisher about this dying business called the newspaper industry.
Exactly.
I was writing about profits and losses in the newspaper industry. At the time I was writing, it was more profits. Now it's more losses.
Right.
But I was totally unhappy. I was turning into the guy I never wanted to be. I was going to work, complaining about work at lunchtime, coming home from work, complaining about work to my girlfriend, and then going back to work. And this idea just grabbed a hold of me about people in the shanty towns, the idea that, you know, one in six people on the planet are living in shanty towns.
Wow.
And it just struck me that these are the biggest builders of housing in the world, and I needed to do something about it. And I didn't have the guts for a really long time. And one day I just woke up and I said, if not now, when? And if not me, who? Mm. And I quit my job, gave 2 weeks notice, and decided I was going to do this even if I maxed out every credit card I had and if I tapped out all my relatives.
Mm.
And I went decided to do it. And am I rich today? That's not the point. I've been so enriched by the experience that I had that I can't begin to say how great it was that I quit my job and decided to do something that I was truly passionate about.
That certainly is inspiring. You've now entered one of the very small list of people who I consider my heroes. Robert Neuwer, thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. His book is Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. I commend it to you. And also, his website is Squatter Cities, is it? Squatter Cities?
Squatter City without the S.
SquatterCity.com.
Blogspot.com, but that's okay.
SquatterCity.blogspot.com. He blogs regularly. Robert, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Hey, it's been a pleasure, Marty.
Great. You be well.
Yeah.
Bye. Well, that was fun for me. God, I hope it was fun for you, as they say. But now we turn to you. You know, I do like to devote part of the show to the big picture issues and part of it to personal issues. And now we turn to you. We only have about 15 minutes left, less than that. But if you are struggling, if you are perhaps maybe most on target for this today's show, if you are one of the formerly middle class, who had a middle-class income, a job or whatever, and now you find yourself as part of the descending down into the unfortunately ever-growing lower income class, not lower class of people, of course, and you would like some guidance on how you might either become self-employed in any way or any other career conundrum that you or someone you love is facing, I love providing help to you when I can. I call them 3-minute workovers. This is the time to call while lines are available. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for that 3-minute workover is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, last week's show was focusing on ways to manage your time better without going nuts. I tend to rush by nature as a person, and I know that is not a good way to save time. But was one item I didn't get to last week that I wanted to make clear to you, and I'm aware that some of you are going to criticize me for this. It's going to seem anti-intellectual. When I was younger, I used to do a lot of book reading, and I had this almost unconscious obligation to go to feel it, like if I'm starting something, I should finish it. Now, I very rarely will read an entire how-to book. I will very often not read the book at all. But my little trick, which is I just love, is on Amazon.com, you know, they have the reader reviews, and, you know, they're not listed at random. They're listed in order of where other readers of those reviews rate them as useful. So the most useful reviews are listed first. And usually, among the most, quote, valuable reviews includes a summary of the book. So I will routinely, for example, because my show focuses on work, I'll look in the category in Amazon over, you know, self-help or workplace or career, and they have books in order of sales, and I will click on it, and I will simply scan the first few reader reviews to find a summary or two of those books. That strategy enables me to scan literally, 100 books in a half hour, and read summaries of the 3 or 5 best of them that are more or least most appealing to me. That enables me to get an incredible amount of nuggets in a very short amount, much, much shorter time than it would take to read one book. So consider reading book summaries instead of the entire how-to books. And a corollary of that is many book authors write articles that synthesize their book. So if you find a book you like, you looked at it on Amazon and you see the description sounds intriguing, just Google the name of the book and the author's name, and you will often find an article that summarizes the major points of that book, another really time-effective way to stay current I love it. Anyway, I thought that might be helpful to you. Let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How might I help?
Hi.
Hi.
Am I the one?
Yeah, you are.
Okay. I'm 60 years old, and I was working as a physical therapist, and I'm now disabled. And in my past, I lived in Japan and taught English, and I did medical editing quite successfully. So my question to you is regarding, there's an online course at UC Berkeley to do editing. It's like 1 year, 18 months. Costs around $4,000. Do you think it's worthwhile?
I wouldn't go there yet. My first step would be to see if I could get... You've already had experience doing related work. What I would be doing would be going to the American Physical Therapy Association website and see if they need somebody to do editing or writing for them. I would also look at other physical therapy publications.
Well, I don't necessarily want to do physical therapy editing.
I know you don't, but to get hired, given that you are a licensed physical therapist, it'll be much easier for you to get hired. If you go and try to write, you know, other kind of health, you know, cardiology editing, you're going to have a harder time convincing them. You may not want to be in physical therapy writing for very long, but at least to make the bridge between being a physical therapist and being a writer or editor, it's a much easier, much more realistic jump to try to do your first writing in the physical therapy space. And only if I couldn't get a job with my existing skill set, then I would ask myself, is it worth the year and the $4,000? Because, you know, especially if you're 60, there's this huge opportunity cost. You know, unfortunately, as we get older, each year becomes it becomes more likely that next year is going to be our... We get less productive as we get older. And so, you know, it's very... Your next year is very, very valuable. So before I gave it up for school, unless I was independently wealthy, if I didn't need the money, that's another story. But if I needed the money, before I gave up a year... The $4,000 is less important, but the year, I would certainly see if I could get hired and, you know, with my existing skill set. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, okay. Thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Let's go over to, I'll give out, we may have room for one more call. So if you have a career-related problem, I'd be happy to give you some help if I can. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko for a three-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, am I on?
You are.
Hey, I appreciate the advice that you're putting out to people. I'm doing okay right now. I've branched myself out since I was laid off. But I just kind of wanted to share a little bit. I thought the story fit in with what you were talking about. I was happily employed as a firefighter for a local government agency. And then with the economic downturn, we lost a ton of revenue because we had a lot of the revenue for the fire department based off property taxes. And so when the property values dropped, so did our revenue, and it left us closing stations and laying off firefighters. And it was just a really striking case to me how this seemed to, you know, come all the way from the top with the banking catastrophe that led to this, all the way down to this little community where they're laying off all their firefighters. And I've since then gone back to school, and I'm working on other avenues. But what I was interested in asking you is if you share with your listeners the documentary Inside Job, is narrated by Matt Damon, came out a few years ago. But I just thought that was a really great documentary, very intriguing, but also explained the situation very clearly. And I'd really recommend it for anybody, but especially, like you had mentioned, the people coming from a middle-class income who are now finding themselves unemployed and struggling with their bills, just as a point of explanation to at least help them figure out, you know, how they may have ended up in the situation.
Did the documentary, I'm always interested in, whether it be books or articles or movies, that, yes, first document a problem, but then also propose a viable and interesting solution. Did that documentary propose something that they think is a viable, smart solution, either for individuals or society?
I had watched it. It's been a little while. I just ordered it online so that I could watch it again and share it with my family and friends. But I can't say that it left me with any lasting impression as far as answers go. but I think it was more of an explanation of how we got there.
Yeah. Okay. I want to thank you for the call. I want to make sure I want to get see if I can help another caller. But thank you very much for trying to share that perspective. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, this is Annalisa, and I appreciate your sentiment about people going to Amazon.com to get summaries of books just because it's time effective. But I just had to call in because my livelihood depends on selling to independent bookstores in Northern California, and it was just painful to hear you driving even more people to Amazon.com because we already have our president doing publicity for them. So I just I need Green Apple Books and Booksmith on Hate and City Lights and Books Inc. and Copperfields to stay around, and I need people to remember to go there to look at books.
For what it's worth, you know, emotionally we all feel more empathy for the little Green Apple Books than we do for the mammoth behemoth. But in the end, is not the world better when, I mean, when I go to Amazon, there are 2 million books that I can read, crowdsourced millions, you know, as many reviews as I want from readers, from experts. I can, if I'm a green person, instead of my driving, finding my way to drive to the bookstore and find a parking spot which doesn't exist or wait forever for public transit, I can get many more books, I can search inside all of the books. I can get them, you know, in a much more efficient way. You know, we can't just hearken for the old days. Like I remember, you know, imagine that horse and buggy makers who were, you know, lamenting the invention of the car, where somebody said, you know, please go, you know, buy your horse and buggies, please, please, please. It feels like ultimately less good is concerned. I emotionally care a lot about little bookstores. I used to go to Moe's all the time in Berkeley, and I used to go to Cody's all the time in Berkeley, but boy, have I read more books and bought more books and grown much more and not have to waste time and gas driving around. I think that independent bookstores, as kind as they are, I'm wondering if net that's the best cause in the world you could be championing. Just a thought. Anyway,
I hear you.
Yeah, I thank you very much for the call. Take care. You know, I like to be able to agree where I can, but I'm not serving you, my dear listeners, if I simply agree with all my callers. Anyway, I've got just a few more seconds, so I always love to fill it in as much as I can. Let me see if there's a quick tip that I can offer you. Just one thing. I really do think that, you know, you talked about making a living in the area of books. I love to write. I still write for every week for U.S. News and another column for AOL. And yet I really, there was a major study done by Poynter, which studies the industry. And they say that newspaper reporter is considered the worst job, period, of all in 2013. It's just the commodity has become so enormous. Everybody wants to contribute. Everybody wants to write. So it is the fastest shrinking field. So yes, as I do, I write not for the money. I used to get paid quite well to write. Now, even though I write for national publications, I'd be eating cat food if I had to rely on that for my living. I do encourage you to think of writing today, unless it's for a commercial trade publication, or, you know, something like an industry publication. Consider that your creative outlet, unless you really are a superstar and you already have that degree in journalism, you were a superstar from Columbia. Think of writing today as something that you do because you want to, because you care to, because it's a creative, you have an irrepressible urge to share, but not rely on it for your money. That's my thought for today. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will devote most of the hour to you. If you or someone you love has a career conundrum, I can usually help you with that, what I call that 3-minute workover. And in between, I will offer my favorite new career tips and my work-life musings. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.